From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Michelle Martin in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Senate Intelligence Committee's report on the brutal interrogation tactics used on al-Qaeda suspects has cast a very bright light, some may say a harsh light, on the CIA. So we decided we wanted to hear from people who have worked there. We wanted to get their perspectives on how the program started, how it was viewed within the agency, and what they think about it now. This hour, On Point, the CIA on the CIA. We invite you to join us on air and online. What do you most want to know about the CIA and the interrogation program? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is John Rizzo. He spent 3 decades within the CIA and 7 years as the CIA's chief legal advisor. He was one of the chief legal architects of the CIA terrorist detention interrogation program. He is author of Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA. John Rizzo, welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you, Michelle.
And with us from Telluride, Colorado, is Robert Baer. He is a 20-year CIA veteran. He once served as the Middle East Station Chief. He is author of See No Evil, which was the basis for the 2005 film Syriana, with George Clooney playing the role of Robert Baer. His latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins. Thank you so much for joining us also, Robert Baer.
Hi, Michelle.
And from Washington, we have Adam Goldman. He reports on terrorism and national security for The Washington Post. Adam, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with Robert Baer because you were an operative yourself. And I take it, if I understand your point of view correctly, that you are actually disgusted by these tactics and you've been in touch with the others at the agency who share their view. Is that correct?
Well, not so much disgusted. Of course, on a personal level, I'm disgusted with what the details that have come out. But I just don't see this program as having worked at all. It's not effective in torture. Just doesn't work. I've observed Middle East intelligence agencies, South American intelligence agencies over the years, and the ones that used enhanced interrogations, if you want to use that word, simply didn't get the best intelligence. And I think the Senate made a good case that most of this information was obtained before the enhanced interrogation started. And if that's not the case, I don't understand why the CIA hasn't produced the evidence.
And have you been in touch with others at the agency? I know you're no longer there and haven't been there for quite some time. Do you have a sense that other people who have been there during this whole period share that view?
Well, I talked to a bunch of people that were there at the beginning in 2002 when this whole thing was started. And uniformly, they say they wanted to stay out of it. They knew this would blow up. They didn't think it would work. It was ill-conceived. It was done on the run. I talked to people that were actually involved in it, and their reaction right now is not so much that it was worthwhile, is that they feel left out in the cold, that they were assured that this was legal, and the White House supported it, and they hoped that they wouldn't be held accountable for this.
John Rizzo, was this legal?
Yes. As you know, I was the chief legal officer, and I am the one who solicited the definitive and authoritative legal guidance on whether or not these proposed techniques, and at the time they'd just been proposed, were legal, whether they were consistent with the U.S. torture statute. And that resulted in what came to be known euphemistically as so-called torture memos from the Office of Legal Counsel, all addressed to me. And those have been declassified for some time now, and so they're there for everyone to see. In short, they concluded, and I should mention we went back to the Department of Justice several times over the ensuing years, concluded that the list of proposed techniques we had were legal, did not violate the torture statute.
Are you satisfied, John Rizzo, that the techniques that were actually used stayed within the boundaries that you envisioned in those memos?
Well, Senate report, and mind you, Michelle, this report was prepared exclusively by the Democratic side of the Intelligence Committee. They have cataloged some abuses, and there were occasional abuses, but insofar as the authorized techniques, you know, those were carried out largely in an efficient manner.
Efficient? Well, efficient, perhaps. I don't know that that's efficient is the standard that we're addressing here. Do you mind if I just ask you, as a person whose entire adult life, most of it, was spent, you know, at the agency, are you satisfied that the agency comported itself in an appropriate legal manner and in an appropriate ethical manner in this area, given that this is a very difficult area? Are you satisfied?
Yes. I mean, at the time the program began, I thought the program was legal based on the Justice Department conclusions. I don't think the program constituted torture. I didn't believe that then, and I don't believe that now.
Adam Goldman, you've been covering this report closely. We've heard from current CIA Chief John Brennan in an extraordinary, I think extraordinary, on-camera press briefing at CIA headquarters. Do you have a sense of where most people within the agency are on this?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of people who work for the CIA, and obviously I haven't talked to them all. But, you know, I talked to a lot of people who were involved in the program. I had a luxury the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence didn't have. I've actually talked to some of these people. And you find some people who are certainly supportive of it, and others who felt that this isn't a path they should go down. And one of the reasons is, A, either they object to the idea of what they were doing to these people, but a lot of these guys had actually been through Inspector General investigations in Central America in the 80s, and they realized how bad these things could get. And they chose not to partake in this particular program. But then again, if you look at a core group of the guys who were involved in this, including Jose Rodriguez, who was the chief of the Counterterrorism Center after Kofor Black in 2002, he was a Latin America guy, and he was involved. I mean, he was aware of a lot of stuff that was going on down there. So, look, it's a broad. You could talk to a broad swath of people and get different answers.
Well, recognizing that it's a big agency, and obviously you're not going to have access to everybody within the agency. But do you have a sense that there was ambivalence about this within the agency?
Oh, clearly there was ambivalence in the agency. Look, you know, the agency was asking for volunteers after 9/11. A lot of people raised their hand. A lot of people stood up and said, "We're going to do this." You know, the Counterterrorism Center ballooned in the numbers of people who partook in this program. So a lot of people stood up and said, "Yeah, we're gonna do this, and we think it's the right thing." Others said, "You know what? I'm not going to be part of this. This can only end badly."
Hey, Robert Baer, you have a strong conviction that one a very good reason not to get involved in this business is that you don't get out of it what you hope to get. It's not worth it. Can you talk a little bit more about what underlies your conviction in this area?
Well, namely the Israelis, Mossad and Shin Bet, their two intelligence services, went through this for over a long period of time, where they resorted to what I call torture, and it was based on the ticking clock scenario where you've caught two people, or you've caught one person, there's a two-person group, and one of them knows where a bomb's going to go off. Is it moral, is it effective to torture that one person you've caught in order to discover the bomb? The Israelis went through this, as I understood, as I watched it, and decided that it just did. There wasn't a scenario like that. They were so rare, it wasn't worth basing a policy on. And the Supreme Court backed off of it, told Shin Bet to stand down. More than that, I've looked at the Senate report, and that thing is meticulous. That the so-called courier to bin Laden was discovered before the enhanced interrogation started. And so much of this information. But on top of it, what really bothers me about it was the CIA is not geared, and I think John will agree with me. I worked with John for years and admire him, that you can't go out and hire two contractors, two Air Force colonels that have never waterboarded anybody and let them run the program. That tells me that the CIA shouldn't have taken this task. Maybe the military. But I think George Tenet, who was the director at the time, sort of simply said, no, we don't have the people to do this. More than that, these two contractors, Jessen and Mitchell, didn't understand Al-Qaeda. They didn't have communications when they were doing the waterboarding. How would they know when one of these guys was starting to give the right answers? They couldn't. And in that sense, I disagree with John that it was inefficient. In order to carry out one of these programs, and I'll say it again, you really have to know an organization like Al-Qaeda inside and out to even begin to understand whether it's effective.
When we come back, we're going to need to take a short break in just a moment. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the role of contractors and why the CIA went to contractors. But John Rizzo, I did want to give you a chance to talk a little bit more about your perspective, that it did yield actionable intelligence, or it did yield at least useful intelligence. Even the CIA director, John Brennan, in speaking to the agency last week, seems to have some doubts about that, or at least to be unclear about whether that's true. So, John Rizzo, why are you convinced that this actually was worth doing?
Well, first of all, Michelle, let me briefly say that Bob Berry is a longtime friend and a former colleague, and I have great respect for him. He served in some dangerous places with bravery and verve, so I have great respect for his views on this. I was in the middle of this from the beginning to the end. I would attend all of the nightly briefings in the CIA Director's Conference Room when the results of that day's interrogations came in, and these were being given by career CIA analysts and operatives, people I knew and trusted, and they were convinced that the program, as it was going along, was yielding valuable results.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking to two former CIA officials about the so-called torture report, as well as a national journalist who covers national security. You can join the conversation, and we're interested in your perspective on who's right here. Did the ends justify the means, or was this a violation of American values? We're speaking with John Rizzo. He was one of the chief legal architects of the CIA terrorist detention interrogation program. He is author of Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA. And we're also speaking with Robert Baer, former CIA case officer. He served as the Middle East station chief. His latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins. Also with us, Adam Goldman. He reports on terrorism and national security for The Washington Post. We're glad you're all still with us. You know, before we took the break, I mentioned that CIA Director John Brennan spoke at the agency in a public press conference last week. He called the Senate investigation flawed and partisan, but he did acknowledge that there were times when CIA officers did not act appropriately. I just want to play a short clip of what he said.
I certainly agree that there were times when CIA officers exceeded the policy guidance that was given and the authorized techniques that were approved and determined to be lawful. They went outside of the bounds in terms of their actions as part of that interrogation process. They were harsh. As I said, in some instances, I consider them abhorrent.
John Rizzo, how do you react to what he said?
Well, I don't disagree with what John Brennan said. As I indicated earlier, there were occasional abuses in the program that were, duly cataloged in this report. So it wasn't a seamlessly run program. I mean, one thing I think is important for your listeners to keep in mind, Michelle, is it is true that we were thrust into this role, a role that certainly in my previous, at the time, 25 years at the agency had never been thrust into. We had never built secret prisons or black sites. We had never had our officers engage in any sort of coercive interrogation techniques, certainly nothing approaching what we wound up doing in this arena. So, just to jump to your question about contractors, the reason I believe contractors brought in is that the people in the counterterrorism center had no familiarity or experience in this kind of thing before either, and I believe they felt they had to bring in some outside contractors, people they considered experts, to at least get this thing going. I mean, time was of the essence, in those first few months after 9/11. Everyone feared and expected a second wave of attacks. So, you know, the context of the times is very important to keep in mind here, I think.
Robert Baer, what about you?
Well, I totally agree. But again, I'll go back to my statement that Tenet, the director at the time, should simply refuse to do this. Hiring these two contractors that had never waterboarded anybody and just read about it in books was doomed for failure. But as John said, the CIA was drawn into a crisis it wasn't prepared for. John and I both lived through Iran-Contra. It was the same thing, where the CIA was drawn in its arms for hostage deal in the 80s, and it ended very badly. The problem is the White House always turns to the CIA when it doesn't know what to do and is more than ready to sacrifice it, as it did on this torture stuff. And I think that's really, if we look at the culpability in this, it's the White House, Condoleezza Rice, and Vice President Cheney who really drove this.
When you say sacrifice the CIA, what do you mean by that?
I think that anybody with any sense should have known that there was no clean end game to the torture thing, that this would come out, that there would be horrible mistakes. I think even the people carrying it out, I mean, when the guy died of hypothermia in Afghanistan, people at that point knew. Now, I know what the CIA does. It sends a justice referral on something like this. Department of Justice investigates. But that's not good enough, because you look at right now it's the CIA that gets the full blame. And I just think it's a panicked leadership that should really get it. And in turning to these two contractors and giving them $81 million is typical in a time of crisis where you're dumping money on a problem which ultimately gets wasted. I think we as a nation are at fault for this, for panicking so badly after 9/11.
Is the environment such that someone could have said no? And John, I'm going to ask you the same question. I want to ask Robert Baer this first. Is the environment at the agency such that someone could have said no? Could George Tenet have said no, we're not going to do this?
He should have said no on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Another falsehood that was perpetuated on us. When he said it was a slam dunk, he didn't know it was a slam dunk, but he wanted to please his political masters. And that's what happened, and the CIA got blamed for that. I was in Iraqi operations. There just wasn't the intelligence to justify an invasion. And Tenet, in these two occasions, both on torture and Iraq, just failed the CIA. But I don't think the CIA should pay for it as an institution. At the end of the day, the CIA did catch Osama bin Laden. I know the story. And it deserves credit for that.
John, is the environment at the agency such that someone could have said no?
Sure. Theoretically, yes, Michelle. But Bob and even Adam, who's an expert on these things, sometimes I think Adam knows more about the agency than I do. But sure, it could have said no. But the CIA's overriding culture, it's a can-do organization. And again, I keep going back to the context of the times. This is just a few months after 9/11. CIA was being implored, it was demanded of them by not just the White House, but by the Congress, and I think by the American people, that they could not allow another attack to happen, no matter what. So that was the overriding sentiment. And you know, believe me, some small part of me, if we had said no, I mean, for instance, I wouldn't be talking to you today.
You mean some small part of you wonders whether you would be here. What do you mean by that? You mean that?
Well, we wouldn't have had this swirling toxic controversy that has really continued, you know, for almost a decade about this program. The report being the latest manifestation of it, but. You know, I mean.
See, I thought you were going to say you were. I thought what I thought you were going to say is you thought that if you had not pursued these, if the agency had not pursued these tactics, that perhaps Al Qaeda would have gotten stronger and there might have been another attack. But what you meant is,
yeah, that's what I was about to say. Oh. Suppose we had said no, and suppose there had been a second major attack on the homeland, and it came out in the postmortem that there had been a conclusion inside CIA that the first detainee we had had all the information about that plot in his head, and that we shied away from using every aggressive means to get that information out of them. I mean, how do you suppose the reaction to that would have been?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have a number of people who want to weigh in on our conversation, and it's interesting that a lot of their views and are kind of all over the place on this, as you might imagine, that they're reflecting the same kind of ambivalence that perhaps existed within the agency. Let's hear from some of them. Tim is calling from Waterville, Maine. Tim, what do you have to say? Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Fantastic that we're having this conversation, Michelle. A couple points. It is obvious to any reasonable individual that the Bush Justice Department decided that whatever they were going to do was to be declared legal, and then they worked backwards from that to justify their legal argument. Second point, I forgot who said this recently, but the quote was something like, protection of the American people at any cost. And one of your guests recently said this past couple minutes. I would respond by saying, really, at any cost? Why are we fighting to protect the Bill of Rights and the Constitution if we're going to shred it in the process? The idea that torture is somehow acceptable if actionable intelligence is gained from it flies in the face of the Eighth Amendment. If we allow ourselves to have no rules, then what separates us from those we claim to not be anything like? The Constitution doesn't exist for us to pick and choose when we think it appropriate to follow it.
Tim, thanks so much for joining us. Can I let Adam in here and ask him if he could address the factual part of Tim's question? Tim, thank you so much for calling. His argument is that they were looking for, that the Bush administration was shopping for a legal justification to justify what they were going to do anyway. And does your reporting indicate the truth or falsity of that?
Well, I don't know if there's fire there, but there certainly might be some smoke and Bob Baer, you know, raised this point with Iraq before, right? You know, we went into Iraq based on a false premise, but that false premise was supported by the White House, and in turn was supported by the intelligence community. So, you know, one can think that if Cheney wanted these techniques authorized, you know, was really the Office of Legal Counsel, was the OLC going to tell Cheney no? Were they going to tell the White House no? I want to touch it. Can I touch on one thing?
Sure, briefly. Sure.
Yeah, sure. This idea of a ticking time bomb, and you know, we needed this actionable intelligence. You know, one thing that's extraordinary about this report is this individual. It documents how this individual by the name of Abu Zubaydah, who was captured in March of 2002, thought to be the number three in Al-Qaeda. Turned out he wasn't. He wasn't even a member of Al-Qaeda. But, you know, they take him to a black site in Thailand. You know, the FBI talks to him. They get some stuff. And then shortly thereafter, beginning on June 18th of 2002, he's put in isolation for 47 days. Nobody talks to this individual for 47 days. He reemerges August 4th, and they waterboard him. If he was such a ticking time bomb, why didn't anybody talk to this guy? It's really a mystery. And the report says because the interrogators had to go home and deal with some family business and needed a break. But if we were preparing for a second or third wave, how is it the most high-level detainee in our custody, nobody talks to him for 47 days?
John, can you answer that?
Well, you know, somewhat. I mean, keep in mind, I'm sitting there back in Washington negotiating with the Department of Justice on whether we could proceed with this program. I mean, what Adam outlines is correct. I mean, it turned out in the final analysis down the road that Abu Zubaydah was not quite the biggest fish in the pond as we surmised at the beginning. But we didn't know that. We didn't know that at the beginning. The available intelligence we had on him was that if there was anyone, he was basically a logistics chief for Al-Qaeda.
Well, no, I think the question speaks more to the tactics that were used. If this was if the ticking time bomb is the argument, that is the justification, how do you justify not talking to him for 40 days? That's the question. What it suggests is that there's a mismatch between the tactics used and the intentions that were used to justify them, or that the goals. It seems illogical. It doesn't seem that way to you?
Well, I mean, now to 13 years later, yeah, it doesn't quite compute. All I can say is, actually, I was not aware that he was actually put in isolation for that period of time while we were working on this thing back in Washington.
Well, to that end, let me speak to a point that you made earlier, because we have another caller I'd like to hear from. Beverly is calling from Glenville, New York. Beverly, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Michelle. Very nice to speak with you.
Yeah, likewise, Beverly. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just wanting everyone to ask themselves if their child was in custody by ISIS or one of the other groups, would they want one of their members put under enhanced interrogation if it meant finding their child, finding out where they are? That's the question that we need to ask ourselves and each other. Don't forget, in 2001, we were at war. We were attacked. Many people were killed. Our two largest buildings were demolished. And we were in a state of war. Now, if you ask yourself, if my child was taken by ISIS or Al-Qaeda or any of the other groups, would I want one of the suspects put under enhanced interrogation? Ask yourself that, and the answer to that will give you your answer to a lot of other questions.
Beverly, can I ask you, I take it the answer to that for you is yes.
Yes. I think that I would want a suspect questioned under enhanced interrogation if it was under a situation of war, or if my child or one of my loved ones.
Can I put you on the spot, Beverly? Do you mind? May I?
Yes.
Are you aware of what exactly we're talking about here? I mean, putting people in coffins, for a coffin-like box for, you know, days, hanging people from the ceiling, you know, the rectal feedings. Do you know that that's what we're talking about?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And I since my child wasn't taken and came back safely, I don't know exactly how my heart and my soul would feel towards that. So if your child was taken, and lots of children have been taken, ask some of those people. Try to get some of those people to speak with you, Michelle, and see what their thoughts are, if they would want these suspects to be enhanced.
All right, let's hear from Robert Baer on this. Robert, we have about 2 minutes left. I think that is the crux of the question for many people.
Well, that goes back to the fishing expedition that the CIA conducted for 5 years. They didn't have a ticking bomb scenario to rescue somebody's child or to stop an attack. I mean, of course, for me, that begs the question, why can't the police do it? Let's say a pedophile has a child buried in a basement. And are the police allowed legally and morally to torture the suspect? And, you know, that's not for me to answer. But the problem I have with the CIA program is they just went into this looking for any evidence they could. And as John Brennan said, it's really quite unknowable what the effectiveness of this program is. And this is where I think it all went wrong. And I think, yes, if we had found a terrorist that knew where a bomb was going to be on an airplane, and someone asked me, we can stop the murder of 300 people, could we torture this guy? I'd probably say yes.
Well, let me make a quick point, too. Yeah, Adam Gold, let me make a quick point about that, too, with Zubeda in particular. You know, they thought he had actionable threat information. They were convinced of it. It turned out he didn't. So what do the interrogators say afterwards? Well, we needed to put him through the ringer to understand that he didn't have that information. I mean, that's really a false conclusion. And is that what we're supposed to do with everybody? You put them through the ringer so you know they don't have any actionable threat information?
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with former CIA officials and a national reporter who covers national security about the CIA's secret intelligence program. You can join the conversation, and we're interested in whether you think it was worth it and whether this will ever happen again. We're speaking with John Rizzo. He was one of the chief legal architects of the CIA terrorist detention and interrogation program. He's author of Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA. And as you can imagine from the title, he's a 30-year veteran of the CIA. Also with us, Robert Baer, former CIA case officer, a 20-year veteran. He served as the Middle East station chief. His latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins. And also with us, Adam Goldman. He reports on terrorism and national security for The Washington Post. We're glad you could all stay with us. And I just want to play a short clip. You know, it's interesting that few people have direct contact with these tactics. But many people now, for all kinds of reasons, because we have been at war for 10 years, because popular culture has taken on this issue, many people now have thoughts about this in a way that, perhaps they did not have 10 years ago. And as I mentioned, that this has been a subject that's been taken up by the entertainment media. I just want to play a short clip from the CBS political drama, Madam Secretary. It stars Atea Leone as Elizabeth McCord, former CIA analyst and now Secretary of State. And in the scene, she's flashing back to Iraq and to the interrogation of an Iraqi prisoner. I'm going to play that for you.
You are going to tell me, when is the next attack going to be? Where and when? This is your last chance. You've got to tell me something.
Al-Maut lil-Kuffar wal-Murtadeen. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.
Try to joke, killer. It's time to step it up.
Do it.
Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.
Shut up.
Allah.
I said shut up.
Well, that's fiction, but I think that's, I don't know, we have questions about that. Robert Baer, do you when you see things like that, what is that, what does that bring up for you?
Well, I work in Hollywood, so I don't have any excuses for it. Zero Dark Thirty, of course, is the one that really bugs me, because I know how bin Laden was caught, and it wasn't through enhanced interrogations. As Brennan said, it's sort of unknowable if it directly led to his murder, if you like. And I just think what we need to do, my important point is, if enhanced interrogation, torture, saved lives, the CIA has to make that case line per line, as the Senate report did. Mm-hmm. The Senate report wasn't entirely partisan. We've got John McCain saying it doesn't work as well. So I think the CIA really needs to make a better case. It's just taken a beating for this for the last 5 years.
Okay.
And if we're wrong about that, then it's got to release the documents. And that is possible because this stuff is no longer effectively classified.
Okay. I think I had a different question, but I'm going to go to Ray here. Ray in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I think he and I have the same question. Go ahead, Ray.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And Golda Meir used to teach school here. And when she became prime minister of Israel, the first prime minister of Israel, Palestinians were blowing themselves up at bus stops, killing women, children, you know, anybody who happened to be around. And Golda Meir, let me quote her before I have to say what I have to say. She said, "I might forgive you for blowing up my children, but I cannot forgive you for making me kill your children." And I want to talk about what this does to the torturers, the men who did these unspeakable, un-American acts to foreigners. We did not torture Timothy McVeigh because he was a white man. We tortured these men because they had brown skin, they were from another country, they prayed to a different god, and for some reason we determined they were not human beings. But what does that do to the human being within the torturer?
Well, Tim, thank you. Robert, I think that's an interesting question. I mean, I think we know that people like you, and also I think John, perhaps to some extent, even though he was, you know, a lawyer, not an operative working in the field, we know that you're prepared to sacrifice your life. But are you prepared to sacrifice other things
after
doing this job? So, Robert, can you talk about that? What about the effect on the people doing these interrogations? There were some heart-wrenching reports in the Senate report about the effect on the interrogators. Should that be part of the consideration about whether these techniques are worth it?
Yes, look at the Senate report, line per line. It's the CIA people, the doctors that opposed, saw that this wasn't working, that it was brutal, and it was destroying them. And a lot of these people, as I've heard, have raised their hands and said, "I want out of this now." And I talked to my wife, who used to be in the CIA and Counterterrorism Center. She just found this just disgusting and sadistic. And it does. It wrecks the morale of the people and probably destroys them in a certain sense. And your caller in was absolutely right. We didn't do it to Timothy McVeigh. We are at fight with another civilization, and we're not going to come off well because that's what they do. It's not what we do.
Let's hear from a couple more callers if we have time to bring some more people in. James is calling in from Santa Fe, New Mexico. James, welcome to On Point. What's on your mind?
Hi, Michelle. I just want to make a point.
James, we're having trouble hearing you. I'm sorry. We're going to let you go, and then we're going to go to Nathaniel, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Nathaniel, welcome to On Point. What's on your mind?
Hi, Michelle. I'd just like to say that I was a soldier in Camp Buka, Iraq, the internment facility in southern Iraq in 05 and 06. And, you know, we would have SF guys come in on hot runs all the time talking to and interviewing and interrogating essentially suspects that they wanted to talk to. And as a gatekeeper, as an MP, we would have to sit in on these interviews to make sure the detainee doesn't do anything rash or violent. And certainly the 18 months that I was there, there was never any enhanced interrogations. There weren't any violent acts from the guys that would come in, the guys in civilian uniforms. I could only assume them to be in the upper echelons of the government, like the CIA, and there was nothing ever like that. And they would get quality, good information from these guys just by not being violent and doing the things that they were trained to do. So if it worked there, why wouldn't it work anywhere else?
Like what? Like what, Nathaniel? Like, give me an example of what was effective that did not involve violence.
Well, they would use tactics like establishing a rapport with the detainee and pretty much taking a "I'm on your side" kind of approach, and you know, sometimes they would give incentives. You know, you do this, you give me this information you know, you can get, this certain, privilege here in the prison. And they would get a lot of good information like that. So, you know, why wouldn't it work anywhere else?
Can I just briefly, Nathaniel, may I very briefly ask you, what's your reaction as a person who's, you know, served in uniform, served overseas? How are you reacting to what you're reading in these reports?
It's appalling. It's appalling. It's surprising. And everything that I was involved in as an MP and rolling over there with some of the special forces guys doing combat missions and providing security, they have always been the utmost professional people. And, you know, it's surprising to me that some of this was going on. It makes me feel sick to have served knowing that was going on the other end of the spectrum.
Well, thanks for calling. Thank you for calling.
Can I wait?
Adam, let's hear from you.
Well, I just like to make a point. You know, the CIA felt like they had to do it. There was no other way to get this information. And in some respect, in that moment, in this moment of burning buildings and national panic and fear, the CIA forgot what it was really good at. You know, this is an organization who hires some incredibly smart people, turns them into case officers. And what do these case officers get people in other countries to do? They get them to betray their countries, right? Betray their countries. If you know, whether it was the KGB or name the country, and they get them to spill their country's secrets to the CIA. And how do they do that? They talk to them. They persuade them. They cajole them. They build a relationship until ultimately these individuals betray their country. So the CIA, in fact, has a long history of getting people to tell them their secrets without beating them up, essentially.
John, how are you reacting to this and what you're hearing in this conversation and other conversations, presumably, that you've been having about this?
Sure. First of all, I want to thank Nathaniel for his service to the country. He mentioned this notion of rapport building. I think Adam just alluded to it as well. This is how the best way to get information. And certainly there are many FBI and military interrogators who believe that strongly, and again, I respect that. But this program was not intended for regular Al Qaeda foot soldiers. This was for the highest value, highest level Al Qaeda leadership, people who would know if there was going to be and when it was going to be a second attack on the homeland. Now, you know, perhaps ultimately through rapport building, we could have gotten the valuable information we got from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But rapport building with the self-professed mass murderer, unrepentant mass murderer of Daniel Pearl, as well as the 3,000 people who died on 9/11. I mean, how long would you imagine it would have taken to establish rapport with a character like that? And time was the one thing we did not have, Michelle, back in those early months after 9/11.
In the time we have left, I wanted to go to some of those kind of the bigger questions, because now the question becomes, and these are big questions, I don't mean to diminish the conversation we've been having so far, because these are all very important questions. But the question, I think, is what happens next, and how does this speak to our sense, you know, of ourselves as a nation, what we want to do going forward, what direction we do give to the people who are acting in our name. I want to go to Lisa, who's calling from Lexington, Kentucky, who has a question to that end. And also, there are a number of questions coming in on Facebook and Twitter along the same vein. So this is one reason I want to go to Lisa. Lisa, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. What's on your mind?
What bothers me the most as an American is that I hear and see other Americans justifying our bad behavior based on the bad behavior of others. You know, if that's how we set our moral compass, we could go back decades before 9/11 and find a lot of examples of hundreds of thousands of people from the Middle East who suffered because of bad behavior of the United States. I think Americans would be far better served to go back, understand the mistakes we've made in that region that led to 9/11, and adjust our behavior accordingly.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks so much for calling. And just to be very clear on this, that there are lots of different points of view on this, I want to mention that we have a number of people who are writing in on Facebook and on Twitter who take Lisa's point, but also who have the same point of view as Tom, who's calling in from Middletown, Connecticut. Tom, what's your point?
Hi, Michelle. My question is, are we all forgetting that this, at the time of 9/11, was perceived as an existential nationalist threat to the nation? It was not a criminal act. It was not a kidnapping. It was not a robbery. It was not a murder. Everybody was concerned that the nation was at risk. Don't you think the nation should transcend all other issues? It's a matter of existence. Don't you think that's why Israel is right now so worried? Same kind of parallel thinking.
Well, that's the question, I think, going forward. So let's hear from each of our guests in the 3 minutes that we have left. I'd love to hear each of you and what should happen going forward. Adam, you're not in the should business. You're reporting on these issues, but I would like to hear just what the conversations are about what should happen going forward. Or is this considered a settled chapter?
I know. I'm cynical about all of this. You know, I think as the agency looks forward, I mean, obviously they're going to do a lot of soul searching in this report. But, you know, 20, 30 years from now, would the same thing happen again? Possibly. You know, as a country, we try to move forward and we look at the past, whether it's the internment of Japanese Americans after World War II or Muslim spying in New York City or Edward Snowden and what we learned with his revelations. I'm not sure the American public, you know, something strikes me about the American public. Parts of the American public care, but other parts are apathetic. And it'll be really interesting to see what the polls say about what the CIA did going forward.
Adam Goldman of the Washington Post, thanks so much for joining us. Robert Baer, what about you? I gave you the first word, so I'm going to give John Rizzo the last word on this segment. So what do you want us to be thinking about going forward?
I was a former case officer, and I would like to a true examination of the intelligence by the Central Intelligence Agency and an outside commission to see if this worked. If it didn't work, there's no discussion to be had. We just don't repeat it. But I agree with Adam. There's going to be another attack on the United States at some point, and people are apathetic, and they're going to say, well, why don't we use harsh interrogations again? I think this will be forgotten in a year. I think Brennan's going to keep his job. This can descend into partisan politics through the next election. So I'm a cynic, too.
Does this change how you feel about your own service?
I think I agree. They did it in panic. It's a can-do. I agree with Rizzo. I know John Rizzo. If the Justice Department said it was legal, that's what he established. But that doesn't... what we can't do is wreck the CIA, because when it does its work well, it does it very well, and it does it by old-fashioned espionage, as Adam was saying, going out and recruiting people, sitting down with them and getting them to betray whatever cause they represent. And it does work, and that's what we can't damage.
Robert Baer, thank you so much for joining us. John Rizzo, final thought from you briefly, if you would.
Sure.
Giving you the last word here.
Okay, thanks. First of all, I would invite my friend Bob and your listeners, if they haven't already, to read the detailed CIA rebuttal to the Senate Democrat report, as well as the minority staff report.
All right. Good idea. Read out, get all the information. John Rizzo, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, supermodel Beverly Johnson is the latest woman to accuse Bill Cosby, and she will join us. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.